Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. On this 4th of July, we will begin with how we are heading for autocratic rule in America with a Republican Party who placed power over principle and a president infatuated with dictators and disdainful of democratic values. We will discuss the unraveling of the left from the 1980s to the Trump nightmare of today with Thomas Frank, the founding editor of The Baffler, contributor to The Guardian, and author of Rendezvous with Oblivion. He joins us to trace the history of democratic socialism in the United States from 1944 to 1977, and we'll explore the schism between the blue-collar workers on the left and the right from a nearly eye-to-eye viewpoint to a perspective a world apart. And on a more hopeful note, we'll assess the groundswell of support garnered by Senator Bernie Sanders during the 2016 primaries and the promising new generation of voters, millennials, many of whom are social democrats. Then finally, we will discuss the latest in the ongoing civility war in the United States with Christine Fair, a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and a former political officer with the United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan in Kabul. She joins us to discuss her confrontation with the white supremacist and leader of the American Nazi Party, Richard Spencer, at her hometown gym, and the booting of Sarah Sanders from the Red Hen restaurant. We will examine the death of democracy and Fair's contention that there isn't and never has been full democracy in the United States due to the Senate being rigged by the Electoral College and the gerrymandering of the House of Representatives by the GOP. She asserts that it may not be too far-fetched to see a civil war in the future with individual American cities revolting against rural red state domination. The only solution to realize American democracy, as she sees it, is massive civil disobedience led by the cosmopolitan liberal base. And joining us on this 4th of July is Thomas Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. A former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Frank is the founding editor of The Baffler and a regular contributor to The Guardian, and his latest book is Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Frank.
It's great to be here, Ian, on this beautiful Independence Day.
Well, yes. So how do we explain the red, white, and blue, the bunting, the celebration, the fireworks, the barbecues, the sense of patriotism? I'm not sure how much of it is being exhibited, but I've been to a number of 4th of Julys and actually found them quite moving. As a foreigner who's become an American, you often feel more affection for the country and its values than native-born Americans necessarily feel. But in the context of your new book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society, that's a wake-up call. But unfortunately, that is the reality, is it not, at the moment, that we are losing our democracy?
It is the reality. And by the way, I'm one of these people who I used to feel very patriotic on July the 4th. It was my favorite holiday for years and years and years. By the way, I'm here in Washington, D.C. I mean, we really go overboard with the 4th of July celebrations. But, you know, it's hard for me to summon up that same kind of patriotic enthusiasm that I used to as a child. I think there's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of reasons for that, but maybe we'll go into that. Maybe we won't. Reports from a Sinking Society. That is where we are. That's what I have written. It's a book of essays, Ian, spanning the last 8 years or so.
Well, obviously, we can't accept the idea that we're sinking. I mean, we are sinking, but we have to bail ourselves out, don't we?
Yes. Absolutely. But I don't see that happening yet. I don't want to be too negative here. But the book is about there's two themes. One is the sort of ongoing gallop of inequality, all through the Obama years, which is when most of the essays were written, and into the Trump years. And the other is the corruption of the professions, which is a theme that I have been interested in for years, but have never been able, you know, I've never really been able to address it until now. And I'm absolutely fascinated by that, that as we come apart as a society, you know, as the glue that holds us together dissolves, this is what it looks like. This is what happens.
Well, the last time we came apart was the Civil War, and it's still the bloodiest war per capita in American history. So obviously that is, we don't want to go there.
Right.
The way I see the country breaking down is because it is essentially unfairly divided between the red and the blue, and the red states have more political power. They have the Electoral College. They've gerrymandered. The Democrats have to win 7 to 8% more votes just to break even.
Yes.
And that's the reality. So we do have, if we're going to have a new civil war, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a violent one, I think the lines are pretty drawn, aren't they, between urban, metropolitan, educated Americans and rural Americans.
Oh, maybe. What I meant by the glue holding us together was that the sense of social solidarity that you once found in this country. And what I'm talking about is that time, you know, I don't personally remember it, of course, but that time from about the Great Depression, you know, through World War II, and even after World War II to a certain degree. And that sense of, you know, solidarity is something that has really vanished in this society, and this sort of idea that it's every man for himself has come to be, you know, accepted wisdom. By the way, just last night such a funny thing. I was reading about Lyndon Johnson, and was again struck by the, you know, to our minds, bizarre fact that Texas used to have liberal senators, mm-hmm. liberals from Texas, and that farmers used to vote for liberals, you know.
And one was a vice president, one ran as a vice president.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. But this gets to the question of what happened to the Republicans, the party of principle, going back to Abraham Lincoln, is now the party of power, the party of treason, you might argue, because they're enabling Donald Trump, who clearly has some peculiar relationship with Vladimir Putin that even suggests treason. So this is the part that I don't understand. It's true that there were, back in Washington in those days when LBJ was around, Democrats and Republican senators knew each other's families, celebrated the 4th of July together, etc. Now it's open warfare. What happened? I mean, we have this phony argument now about civility versus incivility. Again, my concern is that we have a bigger fish to fry, and that is whether we are still going to be a democracy and not become a plutocracy and a kleptocracy, which is where we're heading.
That's right. That is exactly the problem. And you're right that the civility debate is a red herring. It's basically, I mean, because the same people who demand that you be civil, you know, go out and, I mean, you just think of all the, when I was writing What's the Matter with Kansas, just think of all of the crazy stuff that goes on when these people are protesting at abortion clinics. You know, it's the opposite of civility. A doctor that performed abortions in Wichita got murdered. I mean, these are some of the people that What's the Matter with Kansas was about. So civility, of course, look, the way to think about this is the Republican Party are absolutely and utterly cynical. We know what they want. What they want is tax cuts for the rich and deregulation, and they want their workers to have no power. That's what they want. Everything else is a means to that end, whether we're talking about the culture wars, whether they're talking about their demand that you be civil, whether we're talking about, you know, basically their gerrymandering, everything else that they do is a means to that end. That's what they're serious about. That's what they want. Everything else is just a ploy. And that's that's how you, I think that's how the best way to understand the modern Republican Party. Those are the principles. I mean, this is all very clear in something like Ayn Rand, you know, their favorite novelist. I mean, even their religion hits the bricks when it's up against, you know, profit.
That's P-R-O-F-I-T.
Oh, yeah, sorry, exactly. Yes.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas? One Market Under God and Penny the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, and his latest, Listen Liberal. A former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Frank is the founding editor of The Baffler and a regular contributor to The Guardian, and his latest book is Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. Now, as we see, Thomas, the judiciary, federal judiciary being stacked with really right-wing federalist judges pre-approved by Leonard Leo and Don McCann, who's a member of the Federal Society, and we're likely to have this anti-abortion woman from Notre Dame as the next Supreme Court justice. And if Ruth Bader Ginsburg has to retire, then it'll be 7-2. It's going to be 6-3, which is pretty bad. So the question, going back to what you mentioned about LBJ, if you go back to the 70s, the Democrats had enormous majorities in both the House and Senate. And, of course, LBJ was the president with enormous majority he was elected with. You had real liberals on the Supreme Court. You had William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall and others. So the question would be, what happened to the liberals? They had all the power in the 70s, and then starting with the end of Carter through Reagan and up to the present, they've just sort of lost heart, and I don't understand why.
Well, what I try to, you know, I try to explain that in Listen Liberal, and it's, you know, so I criticize the right a lot, and I've written a lot about the Republican Party. But what's happened to the Democrats is just as interesting, because this party from the 1930s up to the 1990s had that majority that you just mentioned. From the 30s to the 1990s, let me repeat that. It's you know, with a few brief interruptions, they had the House of Representatives for 60 years. And they had it because they were the party of the people, and everyone knew it. They were identified with working people very closely, and that's working, you know, they served the interests of working people. And they have lost that brand identity. You know, that's not who they are anymore, and they are upfront about that. They'll tell you that's not who they are anymore. And this began in the 1970s and really took hold when Bill Clinton was president. And you remember he came in, one of the very first things he did was get NAFTA passed. NAFTA was a Republican proposal that was explicitly designed to disempower workers in this country, to strip away workers' bargaining power by making it possible for management to move factories overseas. It was a Republican treaty. Bill Clinton, a Democrat, got it done. And they've basically never looked back since then. And if you look at who they nominate for the presidency and the kind of policies and the kind of industries that they favor, they really are a party that cares very deeply about white collar professionals, you know, affluent people with advanced degrees, and cares very little about working class people anymore. And this has been a recipe for disaster, for long term electoral disaster. And you know, every couple of years someone will bring this to their attention, and every couple of years they'll brush it off and say, well, there's nothing that can be done, and this is what the way we have to go, and this is the only path that is thinkable and that is possible and that is doable. And on they will go. On they will sail, right on to oblivion.
Well, the period we're talking about.
Cheerful? That's very cheerful.
Very cheerful. But I'm going to get to something a little. We'll cheer you up, I hope, in a minute. But I wanted to just touch on that time frame that you're talking about, where the Democrats dominated, particularly the House of Representatives, because they were the party of the people. Arguably, we had social democracy in the United States, or at least a version of it, from 1944 to 1977. And to my mind, that has also been the casualty, along with the Democratic Party. The idea that everybody else in social democracies, it's a very simple transaction. You vote in stewards of your taxpayer money that provide you with good government services. And if they fail, you vote them out. That's the focus, not abortion and all these other issues that have become to dominate the American political discourse. And obviously, the Koch brothers and those of that ilk have been successful in demonizing government itself. And now we, of course, are at the tender mercies of the billionaires, as you've written about. So that is the evolution over that period of time, is to get rid of a sense that the government can help you and sabotage government programs as quickly as they can. And that's what they've been doing, the Republicans. So
who's making the argument, though? The only people I've ever heard who would agree with me. One of my Tom Frank talking points is that if you were, you know, For most people in the northern states of this country in that period that you just mentioned, it was a de facto social democracy. We never had, it wasn't on paper as it was in the UK or something like that. But that's basically what it was in the northern states. The world that I was born into, the social distance between blue collar workers and white collar workers was not that great. It was a completely different world, and today it's as though, you know, people look at that as though it was a, you know, impossible dream, as something that you could never achieve in this country. And I always say to young kids, it's like, we had that. We actually had that in this country, and we've lost it, you know, thanks to all those factors that you mentioned and that I've been writing about for years and years and years. The culture wars and the way the Republicans have manipulated people's populist sensibilities, you know, the sort of natural American populist sensibility, and thanks to the betrayal of the Democrats, it is extraordinary. But that's, you know, this is a moment for reflecting. Independence Day, let's look back at where we are and how we got here.
Well, now for my optimism. Bernie Sanders did extremely well. No corporate money, small donations, no help from the Democratic Party, unnecessary hostility from the Hillary people, who didn't recognize that he would have been the perfect vice president, and had they embraced him.
What a blunder that was.
Embraced him, Hillary Clinton would have swept in. And even the Trump voters supported Bernie Sanders. And Trump was very careful not to go after Bernie Sanders because he knew that there was that crossover between his supporters in his faux white man populism to the real populism, that authentic populism that Bernie Sanders represented. That campaign, I think, identified a whole constituency that sort of came out of nowhere. And that constituency is very strong and very growing, and it's tied in with the millennial generation. And now we've had this exciting election in the New York 14th Congressional District with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So this is something to celebrate and to nurture, isn't it? The fact that
Absolutely.
The younger generation in this country don't buy all this garbage, and they are, you know, without even knowing it, they're social Democrats.
And that's, I think some of them do know it, that is a very hopeful note. I like the way you describe that, because I think Ian, you and I think alike in a lot of ways. You're one of the only people I've talked to who remembers that had Hillary made Bernie her VP candidate, which is the way it should have gone, right? Because he was the only other Democrat who made any kind of splash in 2016. It only made sense for him to be on the ticket, and it would have saved her a lot of trouble, because Trump was, as you just pointed out, Trump was overtly appealing to Bernie voters. I mean, I was at the Republican convention, and he basically said, you know, for those of you who were supported Sanders, he was cheated by the Democratic Party, and I have adopted a bunch of his issues. He adopted them, but everybody could tell he was a hypocrite about that. But he made this overt appeal. She could have easily headed that off by making him the VP, and she chose not to do it. And we're all paying the price for that now. But you are exactly right to be hopeful, although I don't want to put too much pressure on the shoulders of a woman who is brand new to politics and very young, but Let me just say, I just loved the way she beat that guy in New York. There's just nothing better than seeing someone who has very little experience, a lot of good ideas, but no money, no funding to speak of, come out of nowhere and beat a veteran politician. I love that, and I'm very happy with what she did, and I'm happy that her politics are so popular with young people. You know, Ian, when I started writing about these things in the late 1990s, actually goes back even further, in the 1980s, my views were extremely unpopular. I mean, I was regarded as a kind of a freak. And today, there's all these young people who agree, who are on the same page, and I'm so happy about that. It's a wonderful thing to behold.
Well, Thomas Frank, I think that's a nice note to end on this 4th of July, and I thank you very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Frank, who's the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. And his latest book is Listen Liberal, a former opinion columnist with The Wall Street Journal. Frank is the founding editor of The Baffler and a regular contributor to The Guardian. And his latest book is Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the phony civility wars when the real issue on this 4th of July is the survival of American democracy itself. What have we done? How'd we get so far from the sun? Lost in an oscillating phase where a tiny few catch all of the rays. Oh, all of our working days are done, but a tiny few are having all of the fun. Get used to the dust. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this 4th of July is Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan in Kabul, as a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, and she has served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. Her research focuses on political and military affairs in South Asia, and her most recent book is Fighting to the End, the Pakistan Army's Way of War, and she speaks and reads Hindu, Urdu, and Punjabi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me once again.
And you are, of course, a red-blooded American with an interest, obviously, in South Asia. But it would seem that Madeleine Albright, just the other day in an interview on the BBC, was asked, do you think Donald Trump is a fascist? And she said, no, I don't think he's a fascist, but he's the most undemocratic president we've ever had in the modern era. So as we celebrate this day of patriotism, how do we reconcile the fact that our leader may not be a patriot, in fact, may be a traitor?
So I think he's actually symptomatic. He isn't really the cause. The real cause is what the American voter saw in him. And we have had numerous studies, scientific studies that have been done and published since he's been elected, that actually shows that the folks that voted for him actually prefer autocracy to democracy. And one of the explanations for this preference is actually quite straightforward, that democracy, which is truly actualized, all citizens, including people of color and non-Christians and particularly non-white Christian males, have a voice in who will govern us. And opposing this fundamental element of democracy seems to be what's driving many of Trump's supporters. In other words, they would rather have a white Christian male supremacist autocracy than a democracy in which America's true diverse mosaic is represented legitimately and lawfully.
But do you have an explanation for why the Christians in this country, or those that call themselves Christians on the right, support this, what, thrice-divorced libertine who has a foul mouth and says hateful and cruel things and is ripping children from their parents at the southern border and doesn't think there's anything wrong with that?
So I think what has been exposed more than anything is the hypocrisy that progressives have known all along. So, for example, when they would talk about family values is a way at undermining abortion rights, those of us that understood their game, we always knew that this was just code speak for anti-woman. And I think that this has really become really impossible to ignore, right? Because here we have Trump violating every potential tenet that evangelicals would have claimed to have espoused even 5 years ago. And I think that the easiest explanation is the expedient one. He might be a liar, he might be a philanderer, but he is going to actually enact policies that advance their white supremacist, male-centric agenda. And I think this agenda is most powerfully evident in his selection to the Supreme Court. And, you know, I think Republicans understand that that's probably the most enduring and important legacy of any U.S. president. It's why Mitch McConnell, for example, used every possible tool at his disposal to deprive President Obama of his rightful authority to make judicial appointments in anticipation of a Republican president that would actually, you know, not only fill those positions that Obama should have been able to fill, but also new appointments that would become available, such as that which we're seeing with Justice Kennedy's retirement. So this is really what's at stake, is the soul of the Supreme Court.
Well, it looks as though he's going to appoint this Amy Barrett, a professor from Notre Dame, who led a group of anti-abortion people on the faculty. And she, of course, has never really been a judge. She was just appointed by Trump to an appeals court, and she might well be elevated to the Supreme Court as cover, as a woman, and then she'll be right. The one that would overturn Roe v. Wade.
So, I mean, but just be very clear to let your listeners know, no matter what alleged pro-choice Republicans may say in administering a litmus test, all of his judicial appointments have been pre-vetted by the Federalists. And so they don't even have to say that they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade during congressional hearings, because they're on this list because they will vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. I think it's really important to understand that Trump isn't coming up with this list on his own, that in fact he reached out to the Federalists, because remember, when he became the candidate, he had to demonstrate that he was in fact a conservative, that he would enact upon the conservative agenda, because he was not traditionally a conservative. And this was one of the ways in which he has won over the conservatives, has been by his willingness to put forward judicial nominees that have been pre-vetted by the Federalists.
Well, you know, the Christian right basically told him that you won't get our votes unless you make Mike Pence your vice president. He wanted his friend
right.
Chris Christie. So they've had the hooks.
Right, and don't forget though, that the Christian right is also very much tied to the Federalist movement. So
sure.
These are not antithesis movements.
Yeah.
In fact, I was just listening to, I'm not even going to mention this name, but I don't want to give them any undue publicity. But I've made a considerable effort to listen to the right wing nut public, you know, the right wing nut radio programming. And for them, basically the 11th commandment authored by the Judeo-Christian God was federalism, and the 12th was the right to own a gun. So these are not movements that are orthogonal to one another. They're actually quite complementary. And for the evangelicals, they go hand in hand.
And, of course, Don McGahn, the White House counsel, is a Federalist as well. He works with Leonard
exactly.
Leo, the head of the Federal Society, to get these lists together. And as I say, Donald Trump is not just stacking the Supreme Court. He's also stacking the federal judiciary at an extraordinary pace. And that will be, unfortunately, his enduring legacy. Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Wolfe School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and as a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. And she served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center, and her research focuses on political and military affairs in South Asia. And her most recent book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. And she speaks and reads Hindu, Urdu, and Punjabi. And let's turn on this 4th of July to discuss the issue of the moment. I think it's a completely bogus issue, but it's out there, and that is civility versus incivility. You have a completely unbelievably crude, hateful, horrible, disgraceful, foul, vile man in the White House who spews hatred and the most injurious descriptions of anybody and everybody he perceives as an enemy, including foreign leaders like our guy next door, that nice fellow in Canada, who he says the most horrible things about. Why should – well, I'll let you answer. What kind of civility are they calling for?
So first of all, I'm not even going to entertain this as anything but the preposterous canard that it is. I mean, you said it best. Not only is President Trump the most uncivil, disgraceful individual to ever occupy highest office in the United States, he is currently inciting violence against Nancy Pelosi, as well as other senior Democratic leadership, such as Maxine Walters. So, for them to claim all of a sudden that they want civility is just not something I am going to entertain. What they want, of course, in their calls for civility is that they don't want to be challenged. They really have problems with being called out for their hypocrisy, for their support of violence. And remember, President Trump, I mean, well, he actually called for Second Amendment enthusiasts, who I will call ammosexual fundamentalists, to commit violence against Hillary Clinton. He offered to pay for the legal fees of anyone that would physically assault his opponent. So they're calling for civility is, you just can't take it seriously. When the right has called for civility, it's really been a demand that they be shielded from criticisms, that they be shielded from people like me and you who are using our First Amendment rights to speak out against them and to denounce their, not only their amoral, but also their criminal conduct, such as monetizing the White House, such as essentially selling our national security interests to our traditional security competitors, such as China and Russia. And I may even add, not even selling it out at even an impressive price. So I don't take these calls for civility to be any more than standard issue right-wing hypocrisy that we've all become quite accustomed to witnessing if we're not completely embalmed by the Kool-Aid.
So let's talk about civility in terms of what happened at your gym, because I think it's an interesting case. The American Nazi, Richard Spencer, who has gentrified the Nazis in this country by having them wear business suits and look like corporate executives.
I would say hipsters. I mean, I think Stephen Colbert correctly identified him as Adolf Hipster. They're not even like corporate. I mean, these are the kinds of guys that would go shopping at Abercrombie and Fitch. I mean, he's mainstreamed them in every way. In fact, you know, the poor hipsters have had to defend their haircut because it looks too much like the Hitler Youth flopover. Right? I mean, it's very difficult to discern who is actually, you know, a hipster enthusiast and who's in fact an Adolf hipster. It's difficult to tell them apart.
So just describe what happened at your gym.
Well, I mean, I think it's been, despite my best efforts to make very clear what's happened, it's been really misconstrued as I'm a mean, nasty woman, and I have suppressed Adolf Hipster's right to free speech. But in fact, the issue is much more complicated than that. The employees at my gym, which is a Sport and Health in Alexandria, particularly the trainers, are predominantly African American, female, and not Christian white male, to sort of summarize it. And he had been at the gym for a couple of months, and I do a lot of travel, and I had been out of the gym for quite some time because of overseas travel. And when I got back to the gym, I had encountered some of the trainers, many of whom I have known since 2004 when I first moved to D.C. In fact, I knew them from a previous gym and followed them to this gym. And they were telling me, they're saying, you're not going to believe who is a member at this gym. You know, I'm not even going to mention his name because I think he gets enough publicity. But basically, the American Nazi is at our gym. And I said, that's just really outrageous. And in fact, I had learned that our manager had even requested one of the head American African-American trainers to train this Nazi. And the trainers had asked the gym membership to do something about the gym management to do something about him for about 2 months. And the manager essentially told them to suck it up. And they had actually asked me to do something to help them get rid of this guy. And I told them that I would. I mean, I gave them my word that I will help them get rid of this guy. And I told them that worst case scenario, I will help you find a lawyer. I'll help you pay for this lawyer to file a class action suit alleging hostile environment because you're being subjected to this very public face of the American Nazi movement who at every opportunity reviles African-Americans, Latinos, women, and so forth. Unbeknownst to me that while we were having this conversation, the American Nazi was actually upstairs in our gym, and I saw him, and you've known me for years, Ian. You know this is just how I work. I went up to him, and I said, are you, you know, Mr. So-and-so, because I'm not going to repeat his name. And he actually said, no, I'm not. And of course he was. And I was actually, all things considered, civil but direct. I said, as a white female, I do not support in any way, shape, or form your white supremacist agenda. You are a disgrace. You're not welcome in this community. You're certainly not welcome in this gym. And that was, you know, my personal reaction to him. It probably would not have become a major confrontation had it not been for, ironically or not ironically, depending upon your understanding of the white feminist movement in this country, it was a white woman who actually began yelling at me for what she called attacking this man who was, quote, minding his own business, unquote. And I explained to her, I said, well, you know, ma'am, this is who this fellow's name is. You should Google him. He's the head of the American Nazi movement. And hopefully you're going to feel like a complete jackass once you realize this person that you're defending. But she threatened to call the police. She actually escalated the situation to a screaming match. I actually at no point lost my cool, despite the fact that he has, in very characteristically gendered terms, described me as screeching. In fact, he released on the eve of National Autism Day a YouTube video in which he named it Christine Fair's Austic Screeching. So Austic is a misspelling of autistic. And so it's just so appropriate this American Nazi would use the sufferers of autism to impugn me on the eve of National Autism Day. I mean, that's just how Nazis roll, right? But in the midst of this, the gym manager came because of this woman's yelling. And the gym manager and I, we had a previous interaction because I had a hat that said Fook Troop, and he asked me to take it off. And so he accosted me over this American Nazi. And I said, listen, you are in a world of hurt. I said, you, by letting this man into this gym for several months, over and above your employees' complaints, have made yourself vulnerable to a hostile environment class action suit, which I am going to enable. I am going to help your employees sue you. So one way or another, either because you oust this Nazi or because they take over the gym ownership and the suit that I'm going to enable, this gym will be Nazi-free. And the gym manager, his name is Marty, I pointed out to him that you were completely comfortable censoring free speech when it came to impugning Mr. Trump. But you have a problem with censoring free speech in a private gym when it comes to allowing a Nazi to be a member here. And whereas your non-white Christian male employees are all members of protected classes under the EEOC. Being a Nazi is not. And, of course, he continued to lambaste me. And I said, look, I don't really care if you dislike me or not. I don't care if you kick me out of the gym because I'm not going to be a member of a gym which allows Nazis into its membership role. But you should call your lawyer because you're going to be informed that, my interpretation of a hostile environment is actually correct. Yours is not. He was actually accusing me of creating a hostile environment. And his lawyers must have agreed with me because within 2 hours, the American Nazi was actually ousted. And but just what everyone has pitted this as his freedom of speech being impinged upon, what no one has appreciated is that this was a different issue altogether, that the employees have a right to a safe workplace, and that by virtue of him being a very vocal proponent of white supremacy, his calls for ethnic cleansing, his very caustic and repugnant statements about African Americans and other non-whites in the United States created a hostile environment for these employees. And there's a similar parallel to what happened at the Red Hen. The employees, many of whom were LGBTQI, went to the manager and said, look, we feel very uncomfortable that this person who legitimizes the bigotry of the White House
Sarah Sanders, the White House press spokesman.
Yeah. Right. And that's why they ousted her, right, was because her employees felt uncomfortable. And so she was doing the right thing as the owner and someone who has a responsibility to provide a safe workplace. Sarah Huckabee Sanders has no right to be at that restaurant, but those employees have a right to a safe workplace, which is endangered by Sarah Huckabee Sanders being at that restaurant by virtue of the things that she says and she does.
Well, Christine Fair, let's take a brief station break here, and we'll be back in a moment with more discussion on this 4th of July with Christine Fair. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us again on to continue the conversation on this 4th of July is Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan and is a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. And she also served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. Her research focuses on political and military affairs in South Asia. And her most recent book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. And she speaks and reads Hindu, Urdu, and Punjabi. So we were talking earlier about your experience with the American Nazi Richard Spencer in your gym in Alexandria, Virginia, and how the issues involved in that are identical to the issues involved with the Red Hen, where Sarah Huckabee Sanders was ejected because the employees there felt that she represented the people who were guilty of creating a hostile work environment. So let's expand this out now to the broader landscape here where progressives are trying to figure out what to do about Trump. There was on Monday in Brooklyn, there was a meeting of a progressive activist who wanted to collar the Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer. He was supposed to show up, but he didn't. But he talked to them by phone, and they really gave him a piece of their mind. One of them said, "We are in a gunfight, and we have a butter knife." So that seems to be the concern that progressives have, is that making nice in this culture where essentially the old American adage, nice guys finish last, rules, we have a Republican Party that has abandoned all principle for the pursuit of power. What is the, I mean, first of all, isn't the main issue here, it's not about civility versus incivility. To my mind, it's about the survival of American democracy.
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And if people are actually paying attention and they're looking at the non-representative nature of our institutions, they will actually immediately understand that we haven't been a democracy for a very long while, if ever. And I think there are a couple of issues here that need to be remarked upon. First of all, is the distribution of our population. The Senate is an incredibly unrepresentative institution. And the reason for that is, of course, is that much of our population is urban, which means that we have a lot of concentration of people on the coast, but also within Midwestern cities. Yet the Senate is elected strictly on equal representation from each state. So whether you are from a very large state like California or Florida, or a relatively small state such as Indiana, you have equal representation. Many parliamentary democracies have this structure. The difference is that our Senate has all of the major powers of appointing Supreme Court justices and of approving cabinet appointees. Other parliamentary democracies that have Senates with equal representation, irrespective of the population of the state they represent, have no power, right? This is just basically a measure to balance against the lower houses, which are elected on the basis of more or less of proportionate of representation. So we have this incredibly powerful institution that actually represents an ever smaller minority of Americans. The elections to the House of Representatives are also overdetermined by gerrymandering. Where I live, Virginia, you don't need to gerrymander on the basis of race, which is illegal, because you can legally gerrymander on the basis of political affiliation. Right? This is outrageous. And then, of course, we have a court which is increasingly stacked with conservative justices who seem impelled to uphold most of the illiberal values that the right is foisting up, whether it's gerrymandering, whether it's rolling back women's reproductive freedoms, or whether it's rolling back civil liberties or otherwise upholding restrictions upon voter registration. And of course, that is another issue which is undermining our democracy, is that the Republican Party understands that its most reliable base are going to be white voters. And so it has done everything that it can to make it increasingly difficult for non-white voters to vote. So taken together, the non-representative nature of the Senate, the ways in which justices are appointed, again, by this non-representative body, gerrymandering in the House and voter restrictions, we are just simply not in any way, shape, or form a democracy. And the Republican Party, which is, in my view, a party which has long lost its way, it's about molding white supremacy with Christian supremacy and really making strategic ties with our traditional competitors, such as Russia. They're not going to let go of these institutions that will privilege them to a disproportionate amount of power. And so why would we expect the Republican Party to roll back these institutions that will empower them as our country continues to urbanize, and where those of us that live in cities tend to be more cosmopolitan and more opposed to the sort of backward, regressive values that the current GOP espouses? The only way, in my view, is because we can't really defeat them over time at the ballot box, because it's a fixed fight. We need massive civil disobedience of the type we saw in the 1960s. There is no other way for us, meaning cosmopolitan, liberal Americans, to exert any influence that will help make our country a democracy.
Well, given the fact that there is a 7 to 8% deficits that the Democrats suffer from. In other words, the Democrats need 7 to 8% more votes just to break even. So that means you've got to have a massive turnout, doesn't it? I mean, wouldn't the civil disobedience that you're calling for have a purpose, which is get out the vote and throw the bums out?
So, I forgot the most important institution that undermines democracy, and that's, of course, what I call the slave state college, right? Because the slave state college was the slave state college by design undercounts urban cosmopolitan voters, right? It literally undercounts our votes and overcounts those in red states. So I would say that massive civil disobedience should have the following agenda: to get rid of the slave state college, which some people will call the electoral college, to have dramatic electoral reform. And I would put on the table shifting the powers which are currently in the Senate to the House, which is consistent with what other parliamentary democracies do. Rabble-rousing within every limit of the law to turn back gerrymandering and voter restriction efforts, which are really racist efforts to keep non-white people being able to register and being able to exercise their franchise at the polls. Those should be the objectives of massive civil disobedience. This on these measures, this country is not a democracy, and arguably we never have been a democracy. But I think in recent years, where the discrepancy between the urban voter and the more rural voter, and not only our differential demographics, but also the values that we espouse in these different parts of the country, make these inequalities in our electoral system untenable. And if we don't fix them now, I actually have a lot of doubts about our viability as a union going forward. It's just a question of time before cities revolt. And not only are we disenfranchised in every possible way for those mechanisms I've already delineated, we actually are supporting the red states. While the red states labor under the illusion that they support us, the statistics are completely to the contrary. If they decided they didn't want to sell us their produce anymore, we are so rich, we can import our arugula. So not only are we disenfranchised electorally, we are the economic powerhouse of this country, not the red states. And the red states are so ignorant that they can't even understand those basic economic facts. And indeed, they would denounce them as false news, fake news, excuse me.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to touch on how, in terms of what you're talking about, the right, of course, is moving ahead. The Koch brothers have organized a national movement to open up a constitutional convention, a convention of the states. You need 34 states to do that. They've got 28, I think, signed up already. They're very close to a constitutional convention, which would mean that the U.S. Constitution itself would end up as a blank sheet of paper, and the Trump and the Koch brothers would be able to write a new constitution from scratch. That's an appalling, scary prospect. Now, the other thing that's just in terms of what you're talking about, in terms of the slave state electoral college, there is a Silicon Valley billionaire out here in California who's putting on the ballot a proposal to break California up into three parts. But it is so amazingly dishonest, and I don't know how anybody could fall for it. The way that he's broken it up means that you would end up with four Republican senators in California and only two Democratic senators. And my argument would be that the first thing the Democrats should do if they get power is to make Puerto Rico a state, to make Washington, D.C. a state, and to make California two states, both of which are Democratic. Why not?
So I have a different view on this. I mean, I do think that Puerto Rico should be a state. I certainly believe Washington, D.C. should be a state. And the only reason they won't make either of those. Now, look, because of the Trump mishandling of Puerto Rico, we're basically treating them as non-Americans. The racism in the way in which he has ignored the plight of Puerto Rican Americans is just beyond appalling. In fact, I'm bereft of words to describe how horrific it is. But prior to this massive mishandling, I think there's just been a very big misunderstanding of Latino voters. Latino voters are actually much more complicated. They tend to swing right on religious issues. They are unpredictable on immigration issues. You will find some of the most staunch defenders of Trump coming from different Latino communities. Their view is, I made it here, and I want to shut the door behind me. It's very reminiscent of the quote, good Jew during the Holocaust, right? Or leading up to the Holocaust. You know, every German had a quote, good Jewish friend. And they would say, well, you're not like these other Jews, right? This is, we see this repeatedly with minorities. We see it with women. One of the best compliments apparently that a sexist can pay a woman is to tell her, you know, you're not like those other women. You think like a man. We've seen the ways in which these bigoted systems co-opt otherwise members of victim communities. And Latinos are certainly not exempt from this. So when it comes to issues like immigration, they're ambivalent. When it comes to issues of religiosity, women's right to choose, when it comes to women's rights more generally, you simply can't bank on Latino voters being progressive voters. It's a much more complicated, varied electorate than I think many people assume. But certainly after what Trump has done, I probably a fair bet that given the opportunity, they would probably vote, at least in the near term, Democrats, and until the Democrats had the opportunity to also fail to represent them or act on their interests. Washington, D.C., on the other hand, is a straight-up racism, right? It's basically viewed as a largely African-American Democratic vote bank. California, I think, is even more pernicious. This idea of breaking it up, I think, is even more pernicious than you intimate, because on issues of, for example, environmentalism, on issues of fuel efficiency on cars, when California makes a decision, it's silly to have a California standard and a not California standard. So breaking up California actually will take away a lot of the important economic leadership, which tends to be very pro-environment, right? So if you take away California's purchasing power, which you can do by breaking it up into multiple states, and especially if you break it up in such a way that you hand the reins of that power over to this current GOP, you're essentially removing one of the most important bulwarks to this administration's ethos towards the EPA and our other resources, which is God has given us these resources to rape and pillage. In other words, children have an unfettered right to have poisonous water.
Well, Christine Fair, a lot to digest on this 4th of July. I'm very grateful for the time that you've given us here, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Well, maybe in a few years we can be celebrating 4th of July by truly celebrating the liberation of our country from the hands of Putin.
And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and as a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. And she has served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. Her research focuses on political and military affairs in South Asia, and her most recent book is Fighting to the End, the Pakistan Army's Way of War, and she speaks and reads Hindu, Urdu, and this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.